So thank you to again to everyone who's read, helped us open the meeting, and we are a speaker meeting, and it falls on me to introduce our speaker this evening. And I've got to say, this particular individual that's going to share for us tonight kind of reminds me why I do what I do. And they came to our meetings a few years ago, and it's been a gift actually to watch them go through what they've gone through and struggle and find a way through and find themselves celebrating a fairly major little milestone of recovery just recently. We haven't always seen eye to eye, but we get on. It's been a real privilege to watch this person go through what they've gone through and come out and be a valuable member of our group and a valuable member of our fellowship and be of service. So, Christine, without further ado, please share your experience, strength, and hope with us. 40, 45 minutes, whatever you're comfortable with, your journey to, through, and into Narcotics Anonymous. The floor is yours, my friend. Please share with us.
Thank you, Steve. First of all, I apologize to anyone that's heard me recently. I celebrated 3 years clean again on the 15th of August, so a couple of weeks ago, and I spoke at the Australian meeting that week, and then I knew I was sharing tonight, and I asked not to share last week at this meeting because this was the first online group I ever came to because I didn't want to bore everybody. And then I ended up being doing a short share on Thursday in the illness and recovery meeting because the other speaker, I hadn't been able to get in touch with him, so I really apologise. I don't know how different it'll be, and I really don't think I'll speak for 40, anything like 45 minutes. But I'll just get started. Obviously, I'm Scottish, as lots of you know. I was born, even though, as I sit here, I've lived in England for more of my life than I lived in Scotland. I've always sounded like this. I never lost my Scottish accent when I was a kid living in Yorkshire, and I didn't lose my Scottish accent when I lived in London for 30 years. And I was born in 19 in the 19 in 1955. I was born. I'll be 66 in 3 days' time, and I grew up in a family where there was an awful lot of alcohol drinking. There was a lot of dysfunction, is the easiest word to use, I suppose. With parents that did not even like each other. I think their intentions were good. I think they stayed together because of me. But it might have been easier if they hadn't. Because I kind of grew up in a bit of a war zone, and I was brought up as an only child, although my mum had been married twice. My mum had been married previously. This was her second marriage, and she already had a daughter, my half sister, but she never came to live with us. She always stayed with my gran. And that I was aware that it felt it I always felt that my mum felt kind of guilty. I never figured out quite what it was, and I never will now, but I think my mum felt kind of guilty for not bringing my sister to live with us, because apparently that had been the plan until I was born. And then it just had never happened. And there was things that we, so we, but we didn't speak about that. There was lots of things we didn't speak about. We didn't speak about the fact that my dad went out every single night and got completely drunk, and that, my mum was a pill head. And it wasn't a great life. And we moved twice. When we moved from Scotland, where I started off, and where I'd started school on the same day as three of my cousins. There were so many of us. My dad had been one of 13, and so I had a real fa I was an only child at home, but I had lots of family. I had lots of cousins, so I was part of a group of people. And then we moved down to Yorkshire for my dad's work, and at first, but to begin with, things were really difficult there because I had, like I say, lost all these cousins who I saw every single day up until that point. And we stayed there until I was 13, when we ended up coming back up again because of my dad's work. We came back up to Scotland, and the reason I mentioned those things is because they were sort of significant in my life, especially the last move. Because when we left Yorkshire, I just turned 13. And at 13, I was very much a child. Still playing games in the street with other kids, And then when we came back to Scotland, I ended up, they put me in a lower class, because in those days, the Scottish education system was usually a year at least behind the English one. So they put me in a C class instead of an A class. And I ended up being in a classroom with girls who were already sleeping with their boyfriends, the same age as I was. They were 13, but they were, it was a different world. And things for me changed a lot at that point, because I'd always been a high achiever. I'd always done really well in exams. Within a couple of weeks, I was smoking cigarettes. I got drunk for the first time. And eventually picked up one of my mum's benzos and liked it so much, I managed to get myself prescribed them very soon afterwards. And I remember taking that first benzo and just feeling that I'd found the solution to life. I thought, well, this is it. I know what I'm going to do now. And that's what I did. And I picked up again at school. I was always very disruptive. I think I've got ADHD, although I've never been diagnosed or treated. And I was extremely disruptive in class, but I passed my exams, and I did well enough in my exams to go off to university. And when I went to university, it was a big shock for me again, because at school I always had to be in school. There was, I didn't get to be off school unless it was a matter for the doctor. So just being there and being in class and listening with half an ear, which was all I listened with most of the time, was enough for me to pass my exams and get good enough grades to go to university. When I got to university, we had to study, we had to do the work. We were supposed to do lots of reading and lots of studying on our own. And honestly couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. You know, I'd sit in front of a book and try to read it, and I'd just be off in my own world. And we went, my friends and I, who I was at school with, we went and we shared a flat up there, and we went out and got drunk every single night. And then other substances came along. Doesn't really matter what they were, but there isn't, I don't, the only thing I've never used is crystal meth, or ice, as they call it in Australia, I think. That's the only thing I've never used. So, you know, and some of those years were really good fun. I got involved with a guy. Oh yeah, I failed my final year at university and had to repeat it. And in that final year, I'd got in. No, it was while I was repeating the year, I met a guy who was a musician. He was a singer, and I started seeing him. And you know, one really good thing about my family was that they had when they had a family party, it was like our, you know, it was like our own private ceilidh, because everyone either played an instrument or sang, and both of my parents sang, and they sang really well. And so I'd always been able to sing, and I ended up going and doing some backing vocals for this guy. And you know, eventually we split up. And I got involved with another musician, and but then I moved down to London in 1980 to start a teaching job. And the first guy, I moved down with the second guy, and the first guy, oh, you know, he had a record deal by that time, and he again got me into the studio to do backing vocals. And in fact, I recorded a single with him. We did it under a different name from his regular band. It got a few airplays, but it never did anything much. Although strangely enough, no, that's another story. I might tell you that story, but yeah, so I started teaching in London. And it was like, you know, I was never someone that wanted to move to London. It didn't appeal to me. But all I had done before that was to go down there for the weekend, and I absolutely loved it. And prior to moving to London, the drugs that were available to us, I went to university in Dundee, which was the nearest big, well, Edinburgh was nearer, but I chose Dundee. And you know, I lived after I finished university eventually, and I did teacher training, and I still, you know, I stayed up there for another year after that, and then I got a job in London, and we moved down. And in those days in the 80s, you didn't pay rent, you know, you just squatted, and everyone did it. And there was lots of drugs. And by the time, I think I'd only we'd only been there about a month when I had my first habit, you know, on opiates, well, on heroin. And it was there all of the time after that. And you know, I went on to make more records, be in several bands, make you know, and some of them did really quite well, and I actually still get some royalties from that. It's not a great deal, but it's something, and it proves I was there. I really did it. We were the next, me and my ex, our band was the next big thing so many times. But we were too, the companies would put us in the studio to make a demo, and they'd like what they heard, but they usually came down to visit you when you were in the studio, and they saw what went on, and we were too much of a risk. So, we never, our own band never really did much, but we were supposed to be going on tour with the band that the first musician I'd been involved with. So I left my teaching job. We were supposed to be supporting them on tour. So I left my teaching job, and I always say it was because we were supposed to go on tour, but it was really because I was sick of getting up in the morning and going to work, and everyone else just lay around all day and took drugs, and I wanted to do that. So I left my job, and then the first band split up, so the tour didn't happen. So I'd blown two careers, both of which I was doing quite well at within the space of a year. And from then on, it was a case of just getting by. Just I was never a criminal. I was hopeless at crime. I couldn't do shoplifting. I did do a few. I was quite good at forgery. So if someone nicked a credit card or a checkbook or whatever, then I could get involved in that because I could fake a signature reasonably well. And but that was, and I never got caught for anything. And we never got caught using our drugs. My relationship was a nightmare. It was very violent on both sides. But I ended up in a women's refuge a couple of times, and I would, we'd always end up back together again because of the drugs. I would always go back, partly because it was easier for one reason or another, but I really didn't want to be in the relationship, and I knew that, and I didn't know how to get out of it. And I had several scripts, and on one occasion, I went in to pick up my script, and we had regular blood tests, and I was told that my liver was a mess because I never stopped drinking alcohol. Lots of people, at the, when they go on other drugs, they lay off the alcohol, but I never did. Consequently, I OD'd it. I couldn't tell you how many times, and I would I'd wake up from the OD, discharge myself from hospital, and just go back and do exactly the same thing. But there was this. I went to the local drug services, and where I was getting my script, and the guy said to me, "Your liver is a mess. You'll be lucky if you live for 6 months if you keep on going the way you're going." And I was quite shocked. I was there, 32 or something, 32 years old. And he told me that, and I kind of didn't believe him. But I agreed to go into detox, and oh, it was I went into detox, and they decided not to detox me from everything at once, but they detoxed me from alcohol, and they detoxed me from all the pills I'd been taking, and because the benzos stayed with me throughout. And While I was in the detox me, for some reason, it wasn't on a psych ward, and they didn't really have detox wards. They might have now, I don't know, but they didn't have then. It was a general medical ward, and there was people in there with all sorts of things wrong with them. And this woman came in to the bed next to me, and I thought, why is she coming in here? She's pregnant, you know, she's obviously going to have a baby. So why have they brought her in here? Because she, you know, she looked like she was very pregnant. And when she came in, there was a couple of nuns with her. So, you know, I didn't really know what was going on. And because I was being detoxed from a heap of benzos and from alcohol, I wasn't sleeping. So I was awake for, you know, quite a few nights. And I realized that this woman was also a nun, and she wasn't pregnant. She had stomach cancer, and it was so bad that it looked like she was heavily pregnant. And you know, I don't know how many nights I didn't sleep, and I probably got drifted off for the odd hour here and there. But I watched this woman die. I watched her die. And I was really ashamed of myself. You know, she and I felt that she didn't have a choice, and I felt really ashamed. And you know, I realized that I had a choice. And I could do something about my drug use. I didn't know what at that stage, but I remember feeling that the shame, you know, as this woman died next to me. It wasn't pretty. And but I was due to be they put me on methadone again. They left me on that. And they about a week before I was due, sorry, a couple, I don't know how long, a few days before I was due to leave and go home, this drugs worker, and I can't even remember his name or anything, and I always wanted to thank the guy, but he came in with a handful of leaflets, and each one was about a different rehab. And he left them with me, and he says, I'll pop in tomorrow and see what you think, because I'd like you to consider one of these places. And you know, I looked through these leaflets, and there was various different types of places. What they used to call a concept house. Steve will maybe know what I'm talking about. Where, you know, they taught you, they reintroduced you to social drinking. And I read that and burst out laughing because I had no interest in being a social drinker. Social drinking was a waste of money as far as I was concerned. If you weren't drinking to get blitzed, then why would you drink alcohol, obviously, I mean. And you know, I looked at one and I thought, well, I might go there. And it was an all women's 12-step treatment centre, but I had no idea what that meant. It talked about the Minnesota model, but I had absolutely no idea what that meant. So anyway, I went home for a few days, and they'd arranged for me to go into this place, and off I went. And it was in the West Country, and I stayed in there for, I think, 3 months, and then I went to a secondary treatment place, both 12 step, also a women only, for 6 months. And all of this time, my ex had my two dogs, and that was the only reason I was still in touch with them, because I needed someone to look after my dogs, and I knew I wasn't ready to go home yet. And eventually I did go back, and I got my dogs back, and in that place I'd been taken to NA meetings, and I'd really liked them, and I'd believed what people were saying. I believed that these people had used, I could tell. And in order to get a methadone script at the place that I had been going to, you had to sit through group, you had to sit through a group with a couple of workers, social workers or psychologists or whatever they were, I don't know, nurses, whatever, but and no one would ever speak. You just did it once a week, because that was, you didn't get your script if you didn't do that. And they would ask really stupid questions, and I hated it. They obviously did not have a clue, and nobody ever spoke, so they would try and get people to speak by provoking them. And when I was taken to these NA meetings, I knew that the people in these meetings really had used drugs, and they were clean. And I've been coming back to London once a month to see my ex, and every time I came from, when not from the first place but from the second place, and every time I came back I used that weekend, because we never got tested when we came back. I would, I wouldn't use much, but I would use. And I knew I didn't want, I knew I didn't want to be with them. When I came back to London, I didn't go straight back to my own flat. I went to the, what they call a dry house, and he went up to Dundee to watch the football from London, and I went and stayed at his house with the dogs. And that night I used my drug of choice for the first time, and it didn't work. It didn't do anything. It didn't take me where I wanted to go. And the next day I made the decision to just come home, and that the place I was in wasn't doing me any good, and to finally, to go home so that I could have my dogs back and I wouldn't have to see my ex again. And even then it was quite difficult, because he would turn up, he'd once put up he would put drugs through my letterbox and all kinds of things. But because I was a member of NA, because I had a program, because I had a sponsor and I had lots of support, that relationship finally ended. And from there I stayed clean for 13 years. I did all sorts, I did everything that people in recovery do or should do, or what I was taught to do. I was told service keeps you clean. I don't think that's true on its own, but I did service, had a sponsor, I worked steps, I had sponsees. I always went to meetings, I always liked meetings, but eventually, for all kinds of reasons, but mainly because I'm an addict and because I wasn't working my program, I went back out. And as Stephen J and a few other people know, Jim and Ellie, it took me 15 years it's 15 years since I had 3 years clean or over. So, For the last, I don't know, you've been going for 10 years. There was three meetings a week when I came. Jay had just started coming a little while before that. So I don't know how many years it's been, but I've been coming to these meetings for a long time. I've had a few relapses in these rooms, which people know about. And, I never stopped being a member of NA. I never stopped trying. It was really difficult to keep coming back and fucking up again. But, my circumstances changed. It made my life a lot easier. And, I've been clean now, like I said, 15th of August for 3 years. And I know what worked the last time and I know it works. So I'm doing service. I've got a sponsor. I'm working the steps. And I've just started sponsoring again recently myself. So I've spoken for much longer than I thought I would. Sorry, again, for anybody that's had to listen to me far too much recently. I'll leave it there. Thank you for asking me, Steve. And thank you, Steve and Jay, and all of you for saving my life. And that's not dramatic, that's a fact. Thank you.